Right, so I'm Scott Price, this is Kent Davies. So Nolan gave a good background to the project. So to date, we've probably done about 40 oral history interviews, and that's still not really even covering the entire union. It's still really scratching the surface because UCW is an incredibly large union here in Manitoba. I'm pretty sure it's the largest private sector union. If not the first, it's probably the second largest one. 15,000 workers in Manitoba, from a range of workplaces to grocery stores like Safeway, Superstore, meatpacking plants, security companies. It's very large. It's also geographically diverse in the sense that it has offices here in Brandon, up north in Thompson. I believe there's also offices in Neepawa as well. So it's a huge union, and it was originally created, UFCW was created as an international union in 1979 when the Retail Clerks Union and then the Meat Cutters Union at the time amalgamated, and then it kind of created this mega union. So that was sort of what's been happening. Now, when we started the project, We targeted a couple of key events and people. So we basically got a list from the people at the union of people who were either retired or part of kind of the old guard of the union to try to get that history first. So we started with about 25 interviews to begin with. I did some preliminary research and all that kind of stuff. So from those interviews, we started to see some important main events and issues that needed to be highlighted as far as a history project went. So a lot of the first bit of it was, you know, events and themes that would be obvious, I guess, to anyone thinking about doing union history. You're talking about strikes through the years. So there's this one retail strike in particular that we can talk about, which was the Safeway strike in 1978 here in Winnipeg. Now, it was a major event for UFCW, and I say UFCW now, at the time, obviously, it wasn't UFCW, it was actually the Retail Clerks Union. It was before they were amalgamated. We saw that, well, this is a very important event, and looking at it from a broader context, it kind of fit in with what was happening with labor at the time in the late 1970s, where there was a lot of struggles and actions and picket lines and things like that, due to, in the late 1970s, there was an economic crisis. Because of that, there was, you know, there's this thing called, you know, inflation, stagflation, right? So you had wages in real terms were stagnating. The price of just living was going up. And there was also this thing called price and wage control. But, I mean, the ultimate thing that happened there was that they couldn't really control the prices. They could control people's wages. So it was a tough time as far as labor was concerned. As well as provincially, if you look at it, I mean, you had, at the time in the late 70s, you had a Trudeau government that wasn't necessarily all that great for labor. But then also, too, in the late 70s, Stirling Lyon comes in, conservative government, and very extremely not very amicable with unions and things like that. So, and because of the economic crisis, you know, putting in sort of these austerity measures. So there was a lot of that kind of happening at the time. So there's a lot of these issues and then as well as activism happening out of this. So what we're going to show now is sort of one of the many documentaries that we made about the Safeway strike in 1978.
Labor's War, Remembering the Safeway Strike of 1978. 1978 was a watershed year for UFCW Local 832. The year saw massive labor disputes and strikes across Canada due to the fight over price and wage control. Negotiations at the Anti-Inflation Board had stalled, which ended in the termination of the board. In particular, workers and unions were told to exercise self-restraint on wages and benefits while inflation increased the cost of living. Thousands of workers went on strike. UFCW Local 832 was front and center during these disputes in Winnipeg. The Safeway strike started with nearly 2,000 Safeway employees going out on strike. Adding to these numbers were the workers at CERN, Empress Foods, liquor stores, and the construction industry. All of these factors led to 1978 being the year of the strike. What follows are some of the stories and memories of former Local 832 members and staff about the Safeway strike of 1978.
In 1978, we had a strike with Safeway. The issue was the leftover from the price and wage control. We had signed a collective agreement, I think for 2 or 3 years at the time, and price and wage control came the first year of the contract. And the law was that if you are in a collective agreement, you don't have to follow price and wage control until your agreement expired. So when the agreement expired, I think the price control was lifted, but Safeway still wanted to be under price and wage control. In other words, wanted to give us as little money as possible. And it was really only wage control prices. They couldn't control prices. And that's what triggered the strike.
During that time in 1978, when I was working on bank organizing, Safeway went on strike in Winnipeg, and they were and actually in Manitoba. They were by far and away the largest unit that UFCW had in Local 832, about half the membership at the time. So it was pretty much all hands on deck. I mean, they didn't care if I was organizing banks. I was on that Safeway picket line, and I was going to be a union rep. It was one of the first strikes where there was an awful lot of anger. It was a really difficult strike. There were an awful lot of scabs and it was bigger. And people were very frustrated, and the bakery and the milk plant were also out. Safeway's bakery and milk plant were out as well. So there was a lot riding on it. So I worked and was assigned some stores and did some staffing of picket lines, because you know, when you have multiple picket lines all over the place, you need people to kind of keep it together. Picket lines in one place are a little different, so we each had about six stores or so that we had to look after. We had to organize ourselves to be the point person for those particular stores.
There was select stores, select areas where they opened the stores. I was at Portage and Brunel. I forget how long we were out on the street, but then they pulled us and took us over to Ellison Mall because they were open. They wanted us picketing where there was public going in. You know, during the day it was sort of mediocre. We'd block the driveways, we'd go slow, we didn't harass anybody. You know, if people talked to you, you explained why we were striking, not because we wanted to, but because the company wasn't being fair, which most companies aren't. And some people were understanding, they would leave. Some people, you're not telling me where I can shop or what I can do. Other businesses would come and support us.
That was in 1978. What we had done, we told the strikers to bring their cars and park right on the Safeway parking lot. It's public access. So we had about 30-some cars from the strikers parked there. And I guess Safeway must have seen them coming out of the car. So they phoned their towing company. And the towing company came up, and Bernie and I were there. We said, what do you think you're going to do? And they said, we're going to tow the cars away. We said, no, you're not towing those cars away. You don't know if there are people in there, customers, or if there are people out on the line here. So no cars were ever towed. The only thing is, we got photographed, Bernie and I, because the company had all kinds of cameras out there. And Bernie and I, we were supposed to clear the strikers from entering inside the bay where the trucks were backing up to unload their goods. So Bernie and I are supposed to go and tell the strikers to move. Well, we were there all right, but we weren't directing them to get the hell out of the way, so the truckers were stalled, you know. And Safeway tried to make bones out of that. It never went to a court situation, but I know there was some legal action taken, but it didn't go anywhere after that. What they wanted us to do was to stand on each side and leave it open and hold the picketers away from theirs. That was the largest police detachment we ever saw during a strike. Yeah, the reason for that, I think, is because we had approached the Winnipeg Labor Council and Manitoba Federation of Labor, and we had asked their support to load up the parking lot like we had done on Fermor. But on Fermor was only UFCW strikers. So I don't know how many cars showed up, but there was quite a bunch of cars on the parking lot. And then we had a lot of picketers out there, but right the whole front of that store God, I'm saying 25 to 30 police officers lined up, you know, just standing there. Nothing happened. They just wanted to make sure that we were not harassing the customers from going in. And that was fine. We walked in front of the police officers with our line. Just kept walking like that. And, of course, the line, there was two entrances, one here and one there for the store. So we just, and we had enough people that we could cover the whole thing. The officers were there to make sure that the peace was kept, but there was no problem. There was, you know, we didn't get a situation where the cops had to bring somebody away.
And so we had this mass picket scheduled, I think it was a Friday. I don't know who decided this, but the word started going through the crowd that we were just going to slowly leave and go over to Sergeant Maryland. So when I got over to Sergeant Maryland, there was a crowd over there, a big crowd. And things were getting rowdy because I was watching one guy. There was like stripping on the windows, and they were pulling all this stripping off the windows. And it was getting around 9 o'clock. The store was closing. They were bringing out the stabs. And I remember this one young girl, she was crying. I mean, you know, you look out and there's big crowd, maybe 300 people. It was a mob and there was a lot of chanting and shouting and stuff. And she was crying and they brought her out and they had a station wagon and they literally just threw her through that back window into the back of that station wagon and they took off. And there was a guy that came out with a scab. And he worked for the Manitoba Liquor Commission, which is a unionized shop. And he's bringing this girl out. And I'm not a vicious person, but I was. I was caught up in the momentum. And I walked up to him and I grabbed his tie and I says, "What the hell are you doing? You know, you got a scab." And he told me to leave him alone. And then I sort of like, ooh, realized what I was doing. But I was just swept up in the emotion of it. I still remember that, and I was scolding him that he should be involved with this scab because she wasn't a regular worker, she was a hired on. And I thought to myself afterwards, you better be careful, you know, you're going to end up in jail, and then what are you going to do? And so the next time when I went to the mass picket, I was there, but I didn't get involved in anything because I could have really got myself into some trouble there.
As I said, I never thought there was any such thing as bad publicity in the media. And even though it may have looked that way at time, there was always more goods came out of having a relationship with the media than not having a relationship with the media. Peter Warren was instrumental in settling the Safeway strike, if you can imagine. And here's how it happened. The strike had been going on for some time, and during the strike he interviewed me, and he had a line open for Safeway or Vic Pynchon to call, and Vic Pynchon did call, and as a result of that we met and eventually resolved the strike, which is a strange event, but it did happen that way.
It was purely economic. This was an economic strike, and it was over economic issues. And after 8 weeks, it was settled, and I think it was pretty much a saw-off in terms of what people got. But it sure made Safeway not want to have a strike again real soon. And I mean, we wanted more money, and they didn't want to give us things. And so, you know, as is the way in most strikes, you don't get everything you walk out for. And the employer doesn't get everything either. With the Safeway strike, it was a matter of flex. I think it was a bit of muscle flexing and that needed to happen. Sometimes, you know, over time, employers, you know, start to infringe on things slowly.
I was glad when it was over because there's a lot of hard feelings, a lot of hard feelings. I was lucky we had only one in our store, but still, we segregated him. And when I went into other stores, I was told that's the table in the lunchroom for the scabs. And I think some of us older people that were on that picket line, we don't ever forget that. At least I haven't. Because it was a big impression on me. And I was very glad to go back to work. And, you know, we were almost made to feel like they were doing us a favor, letting us come back to work. I mean, that was my job. And I was there to support my living, to get a fair living from that company who at that time made probably billions. Safeway was very, very big then. I don't think even Superstore was around at that time. But just to get a fair wage. You know, those companies have no conscience. If they can cut you down, they'll cut you down. Like people say, they got stockholders. If I was a stockholder, I'd want to have the company do the best for me. But you know, if you're fair and if you're honest, all the rest comes. You don't have to fight for it. If those companies run their companies fair and honest, their profits will come. Treat their people well. You know, you treat a person well, they'll work hard for you. You treat a person shabby, they say, why should I?
What really got me going in this direction was that strike in 1978. It was a bakery, long hours, hot work, and we had a plant manager who was really not a very nice person. You know, he might have made money for the company, but in 78, when I was, you know, when people were getting married, it was hard to get any time off. People would have a wedding social. Oh, you can't have the time off for that. I mean, if you're getting married, and it was real that. The reason it went for 6 months was mainly because of that manager. It wasn't about the money. It wasn't about those issues. I mean, that started it, but it went on so long. Not one person crossed the picket line from the workers, which is unusual. Usually, you know, at some point they'll try and convince some people. At the end of it, he was told to stay up in his office and not deal with any of the people. They hired a new person, a new operations who dealt with people on the floor, Bob Treehart. Things became fantastic. But, you know, how people were treated, how they were handled, I think got me going, pushed me in the direction that it was going to.
When I first worked at Safeway, nobody wanted to be a steward. Like I said, they ran away from the union rep and would hide when they come in. But then as the members in the retail industry saw that the union was there to do some good for them, I was there to protect them and there to ensure that their rights weren't trampled on, they wanted to be included. And if you have to have people wanting to be included in the process, and if they're not wanting to be included in the process, then it doesn't work. So that's what happens when members in a store see that a representative comes in and stands up and fights for their rights. And then people will say, hey, the union's doing a job. Maybe I should be involved. That's what it's all about.
But so that was the one thing. We also did the documentary on the merger that created UFCW in 79. And so we showed these documentaries at the UFCW's 75th anniversary event in April of this year. Now going through that, the whole process of putting these things together and really thinking about the Safeway strike, what was really interesting was that there was different kinds of stories and interpretations and narratives around the strike. And in particular, you kind of hear it a bit in this, is that there was a bit of a difference in how rank-and-file members and more union reps and executives remembered the strike. Because you hear how Bernard was talking about it, and how, you know, even there was one guy, Dennis Allard, who was talking about, you know, how they were putting up these mass pickets and stuff in the parking lots. There's sort of a different tone of how they're talking about it in comparison to the one lady there, Joan. Joan Dudas' story is far more, kind of more of a visceral sort of thing. Like, yeah, there's a very different tone in how it's presented. Also, too, I mean, her part in that, she really makes that whole documentary work. Without the lady talking about what it was like being just a rank-and-file member on the picket line and getting angry about the scabs, like, I don't think the documentary would be as full if we didn't have that. So now, building on the notion of different memories and stuff, what was also interesting was that after we showed these videos, there was a number of women who were in attendance there who then had all these discussions with Bernard Kristoff about the Safeway strike and how he remembered it and what the major issues were. So it was an interesting kind of sit back and observe this renegotiation of the memory. And in talking about this, one of the other women we interviewed was Susan Hart Kulababa. She got involved with the union in 78 during the Safeway strike. So she worked for the UCW from 1980 to 84, and then she became the first female president of the MFL. Here's a clip from Susan, and it'll go into what I talk about, the different interpretations of the Safeway strike in 78, because it's quite interesting how she talks about it.
What I remember about that the most was how we were asking a lot of people to hit the picket lines over issues that were not everybody's. We did have more men working at the grocery stores then. You could use that as a career and make a living at it and support your family back then. Now it's really largely women, and it's part-time work, and they're not going to be there long, 2 years and they're gone sort of thing. But back then it was a career. So there was more men in the workplace. And one of the things they understood is that the women were doing the same work as they were. It was a matter of how much of the time were we both doing the same thing. And the men were being paid more to stock shelves, and then they didn't have their wages reduced when it got really busy and they came and worked in a check stand. But we didn't get our wages raised when we left the check stand because it wasn't very busy and went and stocked shelves. So they understood, a lot of them had people in their families working there. Some had parents working there. Some had girlfriends working there. And those men realized that they would all benefit if women were being paid the same. And there would be less compartmentalization as well. And so they actually came out and were prepared to stand on a picket line with us. And that was very gratifying. That was very gratifying for us. There was still issues around wages in general and those kinds of things, but they weren't saying, well, if you get a dollar, I want a dollar. They were quite prepared to say, I want a dollar and you can have $1.25. Let's get you where you need to be for the work you're doing. So that was very helpful to us. But it took us a while to get there. There was families working there. You know, we had lots of people where they had two incomes and they were both going to lose them. And it was hard on families. So we did a lot on that picket line to build relationships and keep everybody together. We had some who went in at first and then came out on the line with us afterwards because, you know, we talked to them about ways we could help them make ends meet, and so they came out. A lot of the people that went in and stayed in were people who just couldn't figure out a way to make ends meet, but they were always friendly when they came out. They did hire scabs who were not so friendly. And that one wasn't fun, and they paid them more than we made, which was even more annoying, outrageous. So they guaranteed that, and a lot of those people would taunt us as they were going in and things like that. So, you know, or they'd hold their paycheck up at the window and show us how much they were making when we weren't, and, you know, those kinds of things didn't leave our minds when we went back to work.
We've talked about how there's different interpretations of what that strike was about.
Yeah.
You specifically say it was the woman's equal pay issue.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. For us, it really was. And yet, it was interesting because when I saw how Bernard referred to this in what we saw at the 75th anniversary, he referred to it as, you know, really being, you know, about the economics of wages and what was going on with the anti-inflationary board and all that kind of stuff back at that time. And it was like, whoa, he thinks that would have, I wouldn't have gone out just for that, you know. There was a bigger principle for a lot of us. Yeah. But it surprised me that he remembered a different piece of it than I did and put emphasis on it in a different way.
Yeah, so that's Susan. So I thought that was I think what's important to note here is that it's not so much that there's a right or wrong, like Bernard is wrong in his interpretation or whatever. I mean, price, wage control, and inflation, all that stuff was a major issue. If you look through the newspapers and even in their union magazine, that was a big issue in the 70s, in the late 70s. But it wasn't the only issue. So what all that did was really drive home how events are remembered and all that kind of stuff. Now, seeing, hearing these stories, and also from like what you saw in there from Darlene Jevitz and Susan and some other people, we noticed that there was also all these stories coming out about the growth of feminism and in the union, and women really fighting for their rights within the union as well as within their workplace. So we started to document this. So in the late 70s, that kind of where Susan comes in, as well as Darlene Jevitz starts to becomes a union rep, and you have some other people working there. They were sort of the nucleus of women who were really kind of the trailblazers in the union for that. So out of that, we got some really interesting stories about women's experiences in the workplace, the issue over reproductive choice and that kind of stuff. One person that was really important to all this was Mary Johnson, and she worked in the Burns meatpacking plant. So, I mean, meatpacking plants are already highly gendered places. It's a lot of it's mostly male-dominated. It's pretty tough work. There's no doubt about that. And that's where she came out into the union with. I had some good stories from the meatpackers side of it, but they're all men. So it was great to have Mary to kind of see how she experienced, you know, working in a meatpacking plant. So this is another really, I thought it was a really neat story about Mary talking about her experience in the Burns packing plant and this whole issue that women, well, she'll explain it, but there's all different kinds of helmets, but women specifically had to have pink stripes on their helmets. And so there's this whole issue around that. And so we'll play Mary's clip here.
At Burns, I ran after the strike and was elected as chairperson of the plant, which meant that you were the spokesperson for everybody in the plant with the local management. You still, the union rep wrote up the grievances and that, but in plant we did all the investigation and we did the presentation up to the final step to the local management. We had a different union rep assigned to us. Colin Trigwell came in just for a short period of time, and he was looking around, and everyone in the packing house that works out in the plant has different color helmets on. So Colin was asking, you know, like, what do those helmets mean? So the white helmets are the workers on the floor, the gray helmets, I believe, were the shop stewards at the time, I can't remember. And then he asked, what about the stripes? Your helmet's got stripes on it, what does that mean? And I said, don't know, guess because I'm a woman. And he said, yeah, right, you know, he's take those goddamn things off. So he takes the stripes off my helmet, and I said, it won't matter anyway, I've worn this helmet for months without stripes on it, and nothing, you know, it was no big deal, so I'm not worried about this, it's not a big deal. That week on the Friday, Dennis Levy and myself were meeting with Bud Higgins, the superintendent of the plant, and we were dealing with all these grievances, and I think we had four or five of them that we had dealt with, because we were in there for well over an hour dealing with them. And then as I'm leaving, he said, Mary, where's the stripes on your helmet? And I said, oh, they got taken off. And he said, well, I want them back on by the end of the day, or you're no longer an employee of Burns Meats. Bud, give me a reason why, right? You know, because all the girls at Burns wear stripes on their helmets. And I said, well, is that a reason? And he just said, get out of here, and you have them back on, or you're not working here anymore. I went back up to my office. By the time I got back up to my office, my supervisor, we call them foreman, Bill, he says, Mary, and he was in the office. He said, Mary, give me your helmet. I give him my helmet. And he had the rolls of tape out, and he put the stripes back on. He said, you're not getting fired for stupid tape. There's no way I'm letting you get fired for three pieces of scotch tape. He said, phone your union president. So I did, and was told, file a grievance. So we filed a grievance on it, and it went all the way to arbitration. The process of that grievance to going to arbitration was it was painful. It hurt a lot, and it shouldn't have, but it did. It seemed like nothing. When you talk to somebody outside the plant, they're going, what do you mean women wear stripes on their helmet at Burns? When you talk to people in the plant, guys or women, it didn't matter which, they didn't see, what's the big deal? What do you make an issue about this for? The plant elections were scheduled for the same week as the arbitration case. The union had to have a special meeting
to deal with that grievance because people were all riled up. They didn't want the grievance to proceed. They thought it was wrong. It shouldn't go ahead. And there was probably at the one meeting that we had, I don't know how many, but I'm going to say anywhere between 50 and 30 women came to that meeting. I got called names that I'd never heard in my life before. And it was the women that were swearing at me. It was just everything, every name under the sun imaginable. The grievance was a policy grievance. It was not my personal grievance. It was a union policy grievance. Yeah, I aged a few days at that meeting. But it didn't make me believe that the grievance should be withdrawn. It made me feel stronger about it than ever before, right? Than it did before that meeting, actually. The day before the arbitration case, the company put the women's washrooms, we had big dressing rooms, and we had separate hooks that all our smocks were on and where we left our helmets at the end of the day, put your work clothes, you know, put your outdoor underwear on there and stuff. And we had a woman that worked in that. She was modified duties that worked, Phyllis, she worked in that area. She'd worked in my department before that in the sausage kitchen, and she was working in there then. And what she would do, her duties would be, they would take all the smocks that were in the laundry room. She would get them all ready to go down there, and then somebody would truck them down to the laundry room. They'd all be cleaned, and they'd come back, and then she'd fold them and hang them on our individual pegs because we all had our own coats. So what they did the very day before the arbitration case was they put a notice up in the women's washroom that said, from now on, women will have to go down to the laundry room and get their white coats, smocks, the same as the men do, and they will no longer be delivered to your dressing room. And they said, due to some perceived discrimination, women will no longer have to wear stripes in their helmet. The women were furious. They were livid. Like, it was just like a war zone in there. It was the horrible. It was just horrible. We went to the arbitration case, and Mel Myers was our legal counsel. In the company lawyer, they didn't use their regular ones. They used one of the younger, actually a woman coming up in the firm. And I remember her first question was, Mrs. Johnson. And I said, no, that's not my name. My name is Mary Johnson. Well, you used to be a Mrs. She just yelled at me. And I said, well, I'm not anymore, so you can call me Mary Johnson. Use that. But she was really quite upset about that. They wanted to introduce a petition that they'd got most of the women to sign in the plant, except I purposely never looked at it. I knew it was there, but had never seen the petition. So it was something. So they wanted to introduce it through myself, but they couldn't introduce it because I hadn't seen the petition, so they couldn't use it. But basically, it was a petition that asked for the grievance to be withdrawn. So obviously, management was behind it. The whole thing, trying to orchestrate it. Right? We won that arbitration, but I lost my plant election. So that was, at the time, I think you go into survival mode, you know, and get through it that way. But I often wonder now if I would have done it again. My three daughters all say, yes, Mom, you would have. I know I've never put anybody else through it because I couldn't do it to somebody else. It was far too painful. It's a decision somebody would have to make on their own. You know, even though I may have seen people that I really felt should really push that battle to the end, I would not be able to do that to them. It would have to be their choice to do it because it really is not a pleasant experience. And it was horrible. Does it make you tough? Yeah, I think it does. Does it help you to understand people better? I never hated any of them. I had no reason to ever because they were just dealing with the situation that they were in. And they were being manipulated and pushed by management through the whole thing. And I don't think they would not even have realized it. One of the good news stories coming out of that is after after Maple Leaf took over Burns and they... And we ended up having to recommend a contract that we took huge wage cuts or buyout packages for people who didn't want to work under the lower wages. One of the women that was part of that group went on to take women's studies at the university, and she phoned me one day and she wanted to meet me for lunch. And she said, Mary, I have to apologize. That was such a horrible thing we did to you, and we should not have done that. So... You know, so that part is interesting. If you go to the Burns plant, or Maple Leaf plant now, maybe they're still wearing stripes. I don't know. I know they were for years afterwards.
So we saw these kind of stories coming up about this feminism in the local and these stories of women and what their experiences were. And so, again, building more on that is that there was this whole huge issue of unions, specifically the Manitoba Federation of Labor, having a pro-choice stance. And It was extremely controversial at the time. So this is around 82 that this stuff was happening. Of course, a lot of that debate was happening a bit before that as well. But one of the main people that really was pushing this was Darlene Jevits. And, of course, she was in the Safeway strike video as well. But she gives a really great breakdown of how it was her and Susan Hart Kolobaba and some other women and other unions who started to really push feminism within the local and push women's issues, and basically for women's issues to even be acknowledged within the union. Because, I mean, before that, a lot of ways, it was an old boys club. So this is the clip of Darlene talking about them getting the Manitoba Federation of Labor to adopt a pro-choice stance.
In the early days, there were so few of us that we kind of all knew each other. And people, you know, from QP that I got to know, Lorraine Sigurdsson, Sandy Oakley, you know, the Maureens, Miller and Morrison from QP, and Susan and I, and some other women from MGEU, and that started to connect. So there's that whole thing. So how we connected to the sort of the more central feminist movement wasn't, it was almost like it happened in parallel. And we knew each other, but we were more interested in working within our unions because we had our big chunk of things to do there. We connected, we all connected over the issue of reproductive choice. So there's where the bridge came. So, for example, at the same time all the stuff was going on with Henry Morgenthaler opening the clinic here, and the Pauley government was arresting, or not, they weren't arresting them, but, you know, we were urging them not to charge, you know, the women who were working as nurses in the Morgenthaler clinic. You know, Henry Morgenthaler wanted to be arrested. He wanted his day in court, but these women were just helping, you know. So we formed the Labor People for Choice, LPC, because we wanted labor to have its own position. At the time, the executive of the Manitoba Federation of Labor was entirely male. There were no women. And they had an Equal Rights and Opportunities Committee, which was the de facto women's committee. So the Equal Rights and Opportunities Committee affiliated to the Coalition for Reproductive Choice. They did it because the Canadian Labor Congress had adopted a position that was pro-choice. The all-male executive went to Gimli or somewhere, some place sort of north, to have a meeting. They were having the regular meeting. And one of the things they talked about was this uppity committee. And they passed a resolution to order the Equal Rights and Opportunities Committee to disaffiliate from the Coalition for Reproductive Choice on the grounds that the Manitoba Federation of Labor had no position on reproductive choice. So the Equal Rights and Opportunities Committee, or EROC, said, hold on, CLC has a position. They're our parent body. Therefore, we have a position. They were ordered to pull out. The day we heard it happen, it was a Friday. Dick Martin was the president of the Federation of Labor, and John Walsh was his second in command. It's called the coordinator now. It was called the secretary at the time. So we all of us, Susan, myself, Sandra, many of the women in Manitoba, went into Dick's office one at a time that whole day, one after another, just going after him about it. And what the hell do you think you're doing? And why are you doing this? And finally I said, not all together, just one at a time. So it was constant. And I said to him, there's going to be blood in the convention floor on this one. You guys are cruising because we're not going to take it lightly. You don't order us to do things that we have a right to do. And this is fundamental. So we organized and we plotted and we planned, and Dick got nervous because these women were plotting and planning. And that was where I learned the most valuable lesson about you have as much power as they think you do. So Dick took Susan and I for lunch to Sorrento's or something. And we ordered the most expensive thing on the menu just to bug him. But he was saying, how do we stop this? How do we stop this? And we said, rescind. And put women on the executive, by the way, now. That's another issue. So we said, we're taking a resolution. You want a resolution? We'll take a pro-choice resolution to the convention floor. And we did. One of the QP locals managed to do it. All the men, by the way, on the executive were having solidarity. They might have agreed with us personally, but they had to support the executive position because that's what you do. So we organized and we got lots of people to convention. And the bottom, and we taught, we had people over at my house and somebody else's house, and we'd drink wine and we'd pore over how we'd do things by parliamentary procedure, because we always got clobbered on parliamentary procedure. because they knew it better than us. So we learned. And if you do this, you have to do that. And if you refer it back, this has to happen. And the Equal Rights and Opportunities Committee was involved, and we planned. And when we got to the convention floor and the debate happened, it was huge. It was this huge debate. And people spoke so well. You know, Susan spoke very well. Dennis Atkinson spoke very well. And everyone on the other side didn't make sort of an anti-choice statement. They said, we can't take a position. Our members take a number of positions, so we have to be neutral on this, to let people all be free to take whatever position they want. And we said, bullshit. They took a vote, and the vote was tied eventually. First, there was wranglings. First, before any of that started, they tried to refer it back so it would get off the convention floor, because if you referred it back to the committee, it got off the convention floor. And I might add that Gary Doerr was the president of MGEU at the time. And he was another one. He and Bernard and all the rest of them, they just didn't want to deal with it and make it go away. Well, we just made it bigger and bigger. So they finally, through a number of procedural wranglings, and we had people set up everywhere at the ends of all the tables to tell people what to do if they got confused on the parliamentary procedure. So you'd see these people every vote running down saying, vote yes, vote no, vote yes, vote no, you know, so they'd know what they were doing. And they referred it back to the committee. And they thought that got it off the floor, except they forgot to refer it back with instructions. So it passed to refer it back, but there were no instructions saying refer, you know, to comply with the executive's position. So the motion had to be referred back with instructions to say that the committee will disaffiliate. But they forgot. They just said, we're referring it back. So the committee was up at the front stage. Astrid Zimmer was the chair, and she said to the rest of them, they've referred it to us. What do we want to do? And they said, put it back on the floor. So the committee turned around and said, you've referred it to us. We're referring it back to the floor. The debate continues. Ultimately, it was a tie vote. They counted. And Dick, by constitution, had to break the tie. So John Walsh went to Dick, who was at the microphone, and said, it's a tie vote. You have to break the tie. And Dick said, fuck you. I'm not breaking the tie. We'll re-vote. Well, by that point, everybody was just so confused, and people were saying they thought it was rigged because, you know, all executive members were counting the ballots, so they or not counting, right. Counting the hands. So they thought it was rigged. So people turned to our side. We won. We won the resolution. We're pro-choice to this day. And it was a huge, huge watershed. Women became so active after that. We've always had women on the executive since. One thing that did happen as a result of it was they said, oh, you don't need a constitutional amendment to have women on the executive. We'll just make sure it happens. And we said, fine, we'll see. So we took that, and there were three women elected to the executive. In the very next convention, Wilf Hudson was the president by that point, and Wilf said, you know what, one of you has to move off the executive because one of the guys needs to go on. So we said, fine, that's the way you want it. We're going to have constitutional amendments. So we did. We got women written into the Constitution that the top three biggest unions have to have at least two people, one of whom must be a woman. We've always had way more than that, but we do it as a principle. So it's been interesting, and shortly thereafter, Susan was hired to be the secretary to the now the coordinator to the MFL, and then she was elected president. And Manitoba Federation of Labor has been pretty much active. So we channeled a lot of what we did into that Manitoba Federation of Labor Women's Committee. We also changed it from Equal Rights and Opportunities to a real Women's Committee. But a lot of women came out of that that are my age and a little bit younger. And many of us have retired, and there's a lot of really good women coming along afterwards because we learned a lot of about mentoring and doing stuff. So it was pretty, it was a pretty dramatic thing. I mean, you know, if you tell the story and it doesn't even give you the drama of this, and this all took place in Brandon as well. So everybody was away from home, and they were sort of in this environment where we were all stuck together all the time. So it was quite an interesting thing. And it was the real beginning of women recognizing their power. you know? Because you really do have as much as they think you do. They thought we were huge. And it was like five of us sitting around drinking wine. We'll tell them that now. Gary Dewar will still tell me to this day that it was because we had the committee on our side. He's still analyzing it.
Yeah, so that was Darlene Jevitz talking about the whole wranglings of how they got the MFL to have a pro-choice stance. So, with the story from Mary and then with Darlene, that just shows some of the stuff that we're gathering about, women's experience within the local, the growth of feminism. I mean, if you look at who they're representing, I mean, so much in retail are women workers, so much of it. Even a lot of the other workplaces. And if you look at the UFCW's executive board, it's mostly women, actually. So as of right now, we're sort of developing another documentary like the Safeway Strike one you saw about the growth of feminism in UFCW and its connections to the wider feminist movement here in Manitoba. That's sort of one of the ways that the project has developed over the last 2 years or so. So that's a presentation. So if you guys have any other...